In the Brethren tradition where I grew up, it was customary that when you preached, you depended on the Holy Spirit more than on preparation. And we had a running joke about why it is that the last hymn before the sermon always has to have at least six verses. And that's so the preacher has time to prepare. All kidding aside, over the last couple months, as I've celebrated 5 months at Côte de Neige and have been grateful for the things that are working well and have been looking to the Lord for things that we might do better, and one of those is I've been struck again with the need for me to delegate a lot of the stuff that I do, and I'm trying very hard on Sunday mornings to offload some of the things that I do so that I can be much more focused on preaching the Word when I get to that. And I have to say that sitting at the back and just focusing and concentrating and listening to worship going on has really redoubled my need on Sunday mornings to offload even some of my Sunday morning responsibilities. We've got a great team of musicians, a great choir, and I need to depend on them a little more. So I'm learning a lot. Thank you very much. I also want to tell you how much I've appreciated the conversations that I've had with many of you. I have been touched with the graciousness of God in my own life, in my own story. And as you've shared with many, many of you have shared with me some of your stories, it has confirmed to me the fact that I'm not alone in this, that we are broken, needy people who have been recipients of the grace of God. And so I appreciate the connections that we've had together. In a literary sense, this morning we come to what is almost hallowed ground. In the portion that we'll read this morning, there are four or five expressions that have come into the English language. We talk about falling on your sword, and that comes out of this text. By the way, we owe a great debt of gratitude to a man called William Tyndale. About 60 to 70% of the King James Bible English, in fact, comes from the work of William Tyndale, a translation that he did in English while he was running from the king's forces, running from the Vatican's forces. The last 10 to 12 books of the Bible he translated while he was imprisoned with candlelight and limited resources and failing health, knowing that his execution was coming. And there are an unbelievable number of not just biblical expressions, but even expressions in English that are the fruit of William Tyndale as he struggled with the Hebrew and the English, and with the Hebrew and the Greek, and tried to figure out how to express some of these things in English. The words of our Father, the words of some of the poetry we will read today that rings clearly to us in English are really the fruit of his grasp of the English language and the original languages, and so we're grateful for that. I find it tragic that some of the greatest poetry is in fact poetry that is written in very dire circumstances, often on the battlefield at points of despair and hopelessness. You remember Tennyson's words, half a league more, half a league onward, all in the valley of death rode the 600. Forward the light brigade, charge for the guns, he said, into the valley of death rode the 600. Forward the light brigade, was there a man dismayed? Not though the soldiers knew, someone had blundered. Theirs not to make reply, theirs not to reason why, theirs but to do and die, into the valley of death rode the 600, the charge of the light brigade. For those of you that are Robin Williams fans, maybe you remember the words, "Captain, my captain, our fearful trip is done. The ship has weathered every rack, the prize we sought is won. The port is near, the bells I hear, the people all exulting. We'll follow eyes, the steady keel, the vessel grim and daring, but heart, oh, the dripping blood drops of red, where on the deck my captain lies, fallen cold and dead. Oh, captain, my captain, rise and hear the bells. Rise up, for you the flag is flung, for you the bugle trills." And so they come back into port, they have won the battle at sea, but the captain has been deadly injured, and so they come back victorious with their dead captain on the deck of the ship. You only need to hear the beginning words of the lines of McCrae's In Flanders Fields to be gripped with emotion. All of this great poetry written on the battlefield at times of loss. Before we read the words in Saul's life, just a bit of background on the battle today. We're at Mount Gilboa, decisive battle. The Philistines, you remember, on the western flank of Israel. And they have been attacking and attacking relentlessly, trying to break through into Israel. They want territory in order to get the farmland and the lush grass, green fields that they want and the pasture for their flock. They realize they're going to need to defeat Israel completely. They can't just start taking territory by bits and pieces. And so the Philistines, with reinforcements from other countries, have continued to push. They've tried to push across due east. That hasn't worked. Saul had repelled them very well. Saul and Jonathan, in a couple battles that we looked at this weekend, did very well at pushing them back. But over the last couple of chapters, as we get into 1 Samuel 22, 23, 24, 25, Saul is so consumed with killing David that the country is left defenseless. The Philistines have pushed in, and they've in fact cut the country in two. They've managed to push through right from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River and over onto the eastern side of the Jordan River. So in fact, as today's battle begins, Israel has been cut in two. And the Philistines are pushing in. They're hoping this is going to be the coup de grace. By the time chapter 31 begins, the Philistines are trying to complete the sweep of the southern part of the territory. So right about in a band across the middle, there's a series of strongholds that the Philistines have established, and then they're going to knock off the two halves each at a time. They want to begin with the south. Saul has placed his base of military operations in Gilgal. There's nothing going on in Jerusalem yet that we know of, so even the worship, we think the Ark and the Ark of the Covenant, all of that is in Gilgal. So as they've got the country split into two, the Philistines want to start by capturing the south. And so they're going to start pushing through. They push from the bottom, and as they're pushing up, they're hoping their forces will get them up high enough to meet where they've already cut the country in two. And so that's where the bulk of the army is. If this works, the army is gone. Saul is gone. Gilgal, the capital city, is gone. There's a lot riding on this. And as they drive up from the south, their push brings them through a well-watered territory called the Valley of Jezreel, and they keep pushing up until they reach, it's called Mount Gilboa. It's more than just a mound. It's in fact a chain. It's almost a misnomer to call them mountains. They're really hills. The elevation there is just a couple thousand feet, 2,000 to 3,000 feet, and it's really more of a ridge. And the ridge there stretches about 8 miles long, and so Mount Gilboa, in fact, is this ridge that overlooks the Valley of Jezreel. You might have heard of this ridge before, still strategic. Today we call it the West Bank, still strategic territory. And the problem with the West Bank is that it doesn't belong to Israel, but it overlooks Israel. And it's a great place from which to fire rockets into Israelite territory. And so it's still strategic today. It's really Saul, we believe, who has chosen this location for the battle. He's done so for a couple of strategic reasons. Saul has managed to even the playing field in terms of weaponry. Israel has solved the problem with sharpening swords. They've developed skill for metallurgy. That's one of the gifts that Saul has left to Israel after this point. They're making their own swords, their own spears, and they're sharpening them. So they're more evenly matched in terms of hand-to-hand combat. But they still don't have a cavalry, and they still don't have chariots. God had forbidden Israel from trading with Egypt, and that's where the horses come from. A couple of reasons for that. God didn't want them trading with the people who used to be their slave owners. And God didn't want them to have their confidence rest in a fast horse. He wanted his people's confidence to be in him. But the Philistines have been trading with Egypt to the south. They've got this cavalry. They've got these chariots. And Saul needs to find a place where the two armies can face off, but where he can kind of neutralize the effect of chariots and of the cavalry. And Saul figures the best way to do that is to back up his army against the bottom of the ridge at Mount Gilboa. And so that's the stance that Saul takes. And so they are stretched out in a long line. They're at the bottom of this escarpment. And that does a couple of things. It prevents the cavalry and the chariots from just running through the line, which is what they would do in battlefield. So it sort of neutralizes the cavalry and the chariots. The other advantage is that near the base of the escarpment, there's a whole series of ponds. The water accumulates there, and so the territory's not flat. There's a whole series of little pools, little ponds, little inlets. sorts. And so it's not a spot where horses like to go. And so from that perspective, wise decision, Saul has basically neutralized the fact that the Philistines have horses and chariots and they don't. That position, though, brings a couple of disadvantages. If you're fighting the enemy coming at you and you've got your back to an escarpment, there is nowhere to run except trying to get up the hill. And in fact, when we read a little bit later in the battle, we'll see that this is what happens. When the battle goes wrong, the Israelites who are trying to scamper up the hills to escape just get absolutely slaughtered as they're trying to get up the hill because they've got nowhere to run. There's a second disadvantage when you take position like that along a narrow escarpment and you spread out your forces. Normally what you do is that when you go to the battlefield, you want to protect your generals, you want to protect your officers, you want to protect the king's the one calling the shots. And so normally what they do is that they sit at the back, they give instructions from there, and the fighting men are at the front. Now if you're stretched out in a long, thin, narrow line, it's easier to pick out the officers and the king, and in fact that's what happens. The third disadvantage is that if you're fighting along the edge of the escarpment, if your enemy gets in around behind you and gets to the top of the escarpment, they can be shooting down at you. And we think, in fact, that this is the tragic mistake that costs Saul his life. He'll be taken out by an archer, and by the description of the archer's shot, we think, in fact, that the archer was above him and that the archers were specifically looking down, trying to find Saul and his sons. So look with me at 1 Samuel 31, and we'll just read the first 13 verses of 1 Samuel 31. Now the Philistines were fighting against Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines struck down Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. The battle pressed hard against Saul, and the archers found him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor-bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised men come and thrust me through and mistreat me." But his armor-bearer would not, for he feared greatly. Therefore Saul took his own sword and fell upon it. When his armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell upon his sword and died with him. Then Saul died and his three sons, and his armor-bearer, and all his men, on the same day together. And when the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley and those beyond the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled, and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned their cities and fled. And the Philistines came and lived in them. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. So they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. They put his armor in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. But when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and went all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan, and they came to Jabesh and buried them there. And they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree in Jabesh and fasted for 7 days. Lord, we pray that you add your blessing to our reading of your word. In Christ's name, amen. Though this event plays out in the middle of the turmoil of a crowded military battles, I think it's one of the saddest and loneliest pieces of text that we've got in the scriptures. Back at the beginning of chapter 28, as Saul prepares for this battle, he sees the powerful Philistine forces lining up and he is scared. It's the first time in the text that we read this clearly that Saul was this scared. The text in 28:4 says that he was afraid and his heart trembled greatly. He wanted advice. He wanted support. He had refused it all along, but now he wanted it. In verse 6, the text says in chapter 28 that Saul inquired of the Lord, but the Lord wouldn't answer him. I can't think of a lot of places in the Bible where it talks about somebody calling on God and God shutting the door. Saul wants to speak to Samuel, but the text says Samuel was dead. This man has completely isolated himself from any advice, from his family, from anybody that supported him, from God, and he is alone. And it's too late. And so it's time for desperate measures. So Saul goes to a medium. They're forbidden, strongly forbidden, under penalty of death. Saul finds a medium. And she does whatever she does. She conjures up something. And her reaction is interesting. Her reaction confirms that she was, in fact, a fraud and a deceiver and a trickster. It was a game of mirrors and smoke and shadows when people would come to her and say, I want to see my grandmother, I want to see my dad, I want to speak to my great-grandfather. She would do something and call something up. We don't know what she normally got, whether it was a spirit or whether she just played a game with a light in another room or she moved the table with her foot. I don't know what she did. But on this occasion, when Saul comes and says, I want to speak to Samuel, and she does her thing, she conjures up Samuel, and Samuel actually appears, she's scared. Because she did not expect Samuel. This had never happened before. The person she's actually comes up. She realizes there's something bigger than her at work here. And of course, Samuel shows up, and it is not a pleasant encounter. I don't know if you noticed on the program here, I managed to find the stained glass window, and I have been unable to find what cathedral it's from. Three shots from the life of Saul, and the first one is his anointing, and the second rosette there in the stained glass is actually Saul prosternated before Samuel, the spirit of Samuel, rising up from the ground. And Samuel tells Saul everything that Saul already knew. Saul, you've disobeyed. You've lost the kingdom. And then he adds some really scary information. He says, Saul, tomorrow you and your three sons will be here with me. The battle will not go well. Israel will lose. The ark will be captured. And you're going to be here with me tomorrow. And the kingdom will go to David. And I think it's when Saul hears those words that he decides that he's still angry and he's still going to fight for it. Now, I want you to think this through. Put yourself in Saul's shoes. Samuel appears from the dead and tells you, this is it. Tomorrow's battle is lost before you fight. You're going to die. Your sons are going to die. That's it. It's over. Now, at what point do you back down? At what point does even the irrationality of his anger and jealousy, at what point do you say, okay, I give up. David, here's the keys to the palace. This is yours. I'm retiring. I'm moving to Florida. I'm done. And it's funny, isn't it, what jealousy and anger does? Because Saul has come too far to give up, hasn't he? That's his problem. At this point, any sane, rational man would say, all right, it's over. I'm out of here. Think about the hubris. Think about the blinded anger and fury it takes for Saul to go to bed that night, to get up the next morning, to put his armor on, and actually to walk out onto that battlefield. He knows he's lost. It is the irrationality of blinding rage and anger and jealousy has so completely blinded his reason. And so he goes out into battle. But think about the sense of loneliness. Think about the despair with which you head into this battle. So the enemy pushes in hard. The archers find him. He gets pierced through with an arrow. Now, this had to be painful. He's wearing an armor. And if the arrow got him, in a way that was threatening to him. It wasn't an extremity, he didn't get an arrow in the hand or anything. There's only about two or three spots where the arrow could get him. There are about three joining spots in the body of armor where you're vulnerable. There is the neck, there's under an armpit, into the thoracic cavity, or somewhere around the groin where there's some movement of the arrow to allow you to move. So he's either got an arrow in the groin, in the neck, or in an armpit somewhere into his chest. So he's got this painful arrow shot. He's beginning to bleed out. His vision is blurry. And the last thing he watches through his blurry vision is his three sons being killed, one after another. Then his bodyguards are gone. And finally, he's dying alone. He's got his armor bearer next to him, usually just a junior servant. Usually somebody who's not even armed. He's not a fighting man. His job is just to carry the shield. So Saul hands him the sword and he says, here, kill me and finish me off. Do me in. And the young man won't do it. Out of fear. I don't know, fear of the enemy, fear of Saul, fear of killing the king. And so Saul does it himself. It's hard to, with this big a sword, it's a large sword, it's heavy. The swords were heavy enough that they, when you swung them, they in fact did more damage from the weight of the swing than from the blade. You didn't cut heads off, you lopped heads off with it. This was this heavy, heavy armor that you swung. So it's very hard to, you know, and it's long enough that you can't quite. So what Saul does is that he takes the sword and using rocks or digging in the ground, he plants the sword in the ground and he falls on it. It's the only way to kill yourself with this heavy, this big a sword. And it's over. It's done. After 18 chapters of God pleading with Saul, through Jonathan, through Michal, his daughter, through David, through Samuel, after 18 chapters, it's done. God calls time out. That's it. Now, why now? Well, we said yesterday that this battle and the aftermath, if Saul remains in power, will do irreparable damage to Israel. And the point where God's grace comes to an end and he calls time out is usually the point where we are beginning to do so much damage to people around us that God has to put a stop to it. There is a point where God's grace to us and God's grace to people around us hit a wall. And so God sovereignly decides that's it for Saul. Now I want to point something out. God never condones suicide. It's never your call. This is God's call. There's a TV show that I used to watch with my wife, I enjoyed, and the dad was a pretty strong hand in raising his boys, and one of the boys misbehaved all the time, and I always remember the dad looking at one of his boys one day when he misbehaved, and he said, listen, I brought you into this world, I can take you out. There's only one person who takes us out. There's only one person who takes us out. Even David knew it wasn't his job to take Saul out. This armor bearer knew enough to know it wasn't his job to take the king out. When we work with people around us who are bruised and broken and misbehaving, the judgment call that they have had too much grace and that it's over for them is never ours to make. I tell people that I get on the pulpit every Sunday with the feeling that I shouldn't be here, that I'm here entirely by God's grace and forgiveness, that there are several points where, by rights, God probably should have taken me out, and several points along the way, there are a handful of other people who I think wanted to take me out. But here I am. I was talking to a couple of you and telling you that I have a couple of, I call them closet Anglicans at Côte de Neige. And they come to Côte de Neige for a couple of reasons. In the 50s and 60s, when they moved to Montreal from the Caribbean, Montreal churches were still very segregated. It is an indictment on the church that 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is still the most segregated hour of the week. because our churches are still far more segregated than most of our institutions across Canada. And as these people came from the Caribbean to Montreal, they looked for a church where they would be comfortable. And some of them had already arrived at Côte des, and so there was a small contingent of Caribbean people that grew in Côte des at the church there, from Jamaica and Trinidad and the islands. And so there they are. And they're happy Presbyterians, and they enjoy what happens, but there's part of them that still remains Anglican. And when I arrived at Côte des, there's a couple of things I did differently. Not all of them intentionally, some of them because I didn't realize what had been done before. I prepared to celebrate my first communion at Côte des. And I'd just come out of, you know, five or six years of seminary. The reality is it took me 9.5 years to get through the courses I needed. But I just came out of 9.5 years of seminary and was preparing to celebrate my first communion in a congregation. And so I asked the elders, I said, how do you celebrate communion here? And they said, well, you know, the standard Presbyterian way, by the book, you know. It's great. So I went to the textbooks and I prepared just a straight-laced, you know, Presbyterian communion, the way it's done, the way it's in the textbooks, the way, and it's, you know, went really nicely. And after communion, it's great. All the elders came and said, that was great. We've never done anything like that before. Where did you get this? And I'm like, really? But one of the things I did differently is that we celebrate communion on Sunday morning and on Sunday night. We have a Sunday evening service. And the Sunday evening service draws a few of the same people that come Sunday morning, but a slightly different crowd. We have a lot of people in Côte des in the area who work Sunday mornings, and so Sunday night is the only time they can come to church. And so it's kind of nice. Sunday night, I even get a couple Baptists and Pentecostals and other people who are members of other churches, but who on some Sundays, because of work schedule, miss their service, and so they come to us on Sunday night. And so we practice open communion. And so on the first Sunday of every month, we do communion Sunday morning and then Sunday night. And Sunday night, just because it's hard sometimes for me to get some of the elders to come out and to serve communion with me, because on Sunday morning I serve the elders and the old elders serve the congregation. And on Sunday night, I've gotten to the habit that instead of using little pieces of bread, I take one big loaf, I break it, and I serve communion myself to everybody who's there. It's a smaller group, and so that's workable. And when the Anglicans found out that I did this Sunday night, they all started coming to communion Sunday night. Because as Anglicans, they don't like receiving communion from an elder. They want to receive communion from the minister, right? From me. And so they come and it's... But there's something neat that happens. As I work with a number of people in the community, and as I work with a number of people in the congregation who have a variety of struggles, and on Sunday night as I serve communion to a smaller group, often they like coming Sunday night because it's a little less scary than the full house and the craziness and the chaos on Sunday morning. And I've regularly found myself serving communion to somebody who I knew was struggling. There's a lady, a dear sister, and she has started attending now a French church on the South Shore that's closer to her house. And as I struggled with her, and we talked together, and she slowly, gradually told me about her story, and some mental health issues, and eventually led her to drug addiction. And when she hit her low point, she was caught downtown with her 12-year-old son, trying to pimp out her 12-year-old son for sex to get money to buy drugs. This is where she hit bottom. And the Lord has been good to her and has restored her relationship with her son, and he's a beautiful young man studying in seminary now. But she always felt that because of what she had done, because of what she had been through, because of her mental illness, that she was somehow unworthy. She didn't want to come Sunday morning because there were too many good people Sunday morning, and she didn't fit. And as I talked to her, I realized that she hadn't taken communion for a long, long time. She had taken communion as a child after she was confirmed, and it had been over 20 years since she's taken communion. And she came to every communion service, and she sat, and she let the bread and the wine go by. And I had this conversation with her, and as we were talking, I told her, I said, in 3 weeks, it's the first Sunday of the month, and you're going to take communion. And she said, I can't. I said, you need to take communion. And we had this moment. I served, and she always sits in the corner at the back. And we've got a great jazz pianist who plays with us on Sunday night, and he sort of accompanies. And then while he plays instrumentally while I'm serving the emblems. And normally with a small crowd of 15 to 20 people, you know, it'll take me a couple minutes to go through the crowd. And on this Sunday night, and she was there, and I had told her. And I got in front of her, and I came to her with the bread. And she looked at me, and she shook her head. And I looked at her, and I shook my head. And she shook her head, and I shook my head, and shook her head. I was standing there for almost 2 minutes. And at this point, everybody at the front is wondering, where'd he go? Where's what's going on? You know, did he leave? And eventually, just very fearful and with trepidation, sort of half looking up for the shot of lightning coming through the ceiling, she reached out and she took the bread. I have come to the conclusion that one of the reasons God wanted me in ministry is the fact that I was given a second, third, fourth, fifth, eighth, tenth chance. I'm there by the grace of God. And one of my callings is to insist on other people who need the second, third, fourth, fifth chance. For some people, the point comes where God pulls the plug, as he does on Saul today. Okay? But pulling the plug is not your job, and it's not my job. You leave that to God. As we work with people, whether they're a Saul, whether they're a woman with a drug addiction issue who tried to pimp her son, we are giving second and third and fourth chances. We are called to minister grace. Judgment is not part of our contract. There are three lessons that I want to pull out of the text today, and then maybe give you a couple minutes for questions. First one I like to call alternative endings. I do a fair bit of writing, and been published, and that's really cool. And one of my great frustrations that I've written a fair amount of fiction and never been able to get any of it published. And my wife thinks I'm a pretty good storyteller, so she thinks that, you know, one or two of my seven or eight novels that I've written, I should actually finish them one day and try and get them published. And one of the challenges with being a storyteller and enjoying telling stories is usually when I read fiction, I'm usually disappointed when I get to the end and I go, man, that's a lousy ending. You know, that's not the way it should have ended. You know, this guy should have done this and then that would have been better. Then, you do that when you read a book, you read a story and you go, that's a stupid ending. That's not the way it should have ended. You know, it should have ended like this, but you know, it's like, and I like to dream and think of alternate endings. And when I look at the life of Saul, I want to suggest to you that there are many ways in which this could have played out differently. I was chatting with one of the groups yesterday. What if at some point before 1 Samuel 31, the lights came on and Saul had voluntarily stepped down? What if Saul had voluntarily stepped down, David had led the battle at Mount Gilboa, Israelites could have won, would Saul's life have been spared? Even more significantly, would Jonathan's life have been spared? Imagine an alternate universe where three or four chapters ago, Saul retires, moves to Florida, Egypt, wherever. Jonathan becomes general fighting next to David. Can you imagine the possibilities of David and Jonathan fighting together to restore Israel? Can you imagine what that would have looked like? And say, well, you know, David, you know, how could David forgive what Saul had done to him? And well, about seven or eight chapters later in 2 Samuel 9, David, still out of grace for Jonathan and still out of kindness for Saul, after Saul and Jonathan are dead, he asks the question, he says, is there anybody still alive from Saul and Jonathan's house that I may show kindness to him for the memory of Saul and Jonathan? Knowing that that's who David was, imagine what David would have done. Imagine what could have been possible. Imagine the effort, the wasted effort that could have been redeemed. Imagine how different the fate of this country could have been. Imagine how differently it could have played out for Saul's three sons, for that family, for everyone, if only Saul had done it differently. I can think of a dozen more positive possible endings and scenarios than this one. Nobody's future is hardwired from the beginning. Now, okay, on another day, you and I will have a conversation about predestination, okay? That's not a subject today. One of my fears as we do all of the DNA studies that we're doing now with the genome, you know, we're doing this DNA research on kids in the womb, and we know that they've got, you know, 73 chances of having an ingrown toenail and 23% chance of getting lung cancer and 10% chances of being blonde, and, you know, we've got all, and we think we've got all this figured out. And one of my fears as we do this is that what happens when we get to the point where we discover that somebody's got the gene to be a kleptomaniac? Well, I, you know, it's in my genes, sorry, I steal. That's you know, I was born this way. This way it plays out. You ever, my wife and I don't drive fancy cars. The Impala there is a rental, by the way. I'll tell you the story if you want to know. The Impala is a rental, okay? We don't have a second car. When we need one, I rent one. And I've got this horrible relationship with the guy at the car rental agency. I gave him my card one time. He discovered I was a priest or a minister, a rabbi. I said, oh, no, you can't drive this compact. I can't rent you a Hyundai Accent. No. So he charges me for compact, and I've got an Impala. One of the last times that was a BMW 3 Series. At one point, I'm going to meet fundraisers for the Bible Society. I pick up a rental car, and he gives me a 5 Series BMW with it. And I go, I can't take this car. I can't. Yeah, you know, no, you got it. It's, you know, it's good. You're God. You know, you're, and I think the guy thinks he's earning his way into heaven by giving me nice cars. Anyway, so most of the time I enjoyed it. I got to tell you, I went to meet that donor and I parked 4 blocks away and I walked just to make sure. We assume that everybody's life is a straight line trajectory. My dad was an alcoholic. My family was bad. My job's no good. So Debbie and I, because we don't drive nice cars, because we don't take fancy holidays, the timing doesn't work. The one thing we do is that every so often we go watch a movie together. That's our fun. We go to Cheapy Tuesdays. And spend what we wouldn't have spent on the movie ticket on popcorn. You know, I tell people that the last time I went to a movie, I ate $30 worth of popcorn. It was about this big. And one of the movies I remember, it was sort of a sci-fi movie that Debbie didn't really enjoy, but it was called Minority Report. I don't know if you remember it. And it's sort of in the future, and the way crime prevention happens is they've got the whole planet on cameras. They've got everybody's DNA run. They can read everybody's mind. And so some guy walks into a convenience store and he thinks about stealing a pint of milk. Well, they jump in before he actually steals a pint of milk. But the question is, does everybody who goes to a store think about stealing a pint of milk actually steal the pint of milk? And it raises the question about who are we and how are we determined and how is our future determined and how are things hardwired for us? And I want to suggest to you again that Saul's future was not hardwired. It was not carved in stone from the beginning. He was not set up to fail by God. There are 100 different ways I can think of that his story could have ended well. But Saul made these choices. So Stephen Covey, great writer, too bad he was a Mormon. But Stephen Covey, in his book, 7 Habits of Highly Successful People, hit 2 or 3 nails right on the head. And one of them, he said this, you got to begin with the end in mind. And he challenges people to think about what they want inscribed on their gravestone after they're gone. How do you want your life to end? How do you want things to wrap up? How do you want to be remembered? I guarantee that if you'd asked Saul when he was a young man, how do you want your life to end? He wouldn't have said, well, on my last day on earth, I want to watch my 3 sons die in battle and then fall on my sword. That's the way I want to go out. Guarantee. But there are things that Saul could have done, should have done along the way to make it end differently. So I want to challenge you. There may be people around you who assume things about the way you're going to wind up. you might even be making assumptions in your heart about how, unfortunately, you're going to wind up. You know, you would have liked it different, but, you know, this is who I am. What can I, this is, you know. And I want to move you away from that lie, because that's a lie. It's in your hands. How you finish is up to you. And how you finish in a year, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, depends on what you do today, what you do tomorrow, the choices you make, the course corrections you make. Remember that French expression, il y a de la vie, il y a de l'espoir? As long as you're still breathing, it's still fixable. What are the course corrections you need to make to end the way you want to end? And here's a second thought. Most of us usually know when it's time to go somewhere, to arrive, to start. A lot of us don't know when it's time to leave. A lot of us overstay our welcome, like Saul did. There are points in our lives where we are beyond our depth, where it's time to go, where it's time to realize that we're no longer what's needed. And I got to tell you, sometimes it's hard to make that call. And sometimes it's a timing issue, and sometimes it's a place issue. Debbie and I, when we got married, wanted to have kids. We were hoping to have a large family. And the Lord had other plans. We struggled together through 11 miscarriages. 8 times we got slightly past the end of the first trimester. And the frustration is, we went to the doctors, we had all the tests. I got to tell you, I have done unimaginable things to styrofoam cups and cubicles in doctors' offices that you don't want to think about. And after all the tests, the doctors came back and said, there's no reason. We don't understand. And as I struggled with the pain of wanting to be a father, I found myself completely unable to understand what Debbie was going through. Because it's one thing for me as a man to say, okay, God's chosen it this way, we're going to foster, we're going to adopt, we'll have children this way. I have no idea what it feels like for a woman to have an empty womb, they call it. And as I struggled to be good to my wife, to be kind to her, I realized that there's some things about which she just needed the comfort of other women. And at first, part of me recoiled against the idea that there was this need that my wife had that I wasn't the one who could meet. It sort of does things to your ego. I'm a pastor, I do marriage counseling, what do you mean, we need to know that there's some points where this is not our job. There's sometimes we need to know it's time to pack it in and let somebody else do this. We celebrate this year the 50th anniversary of Expo 67. For us as French evangelicals in Canada, Expo 67 was very, very significant. And a number of Christian churches got together. And when they realized that the World's Fair was coming to Montreal, they put together something called Sermons from Science. It was a pavilion. It was put together with Moody Science, with Moody Films. And it was great, a great setup. You would walk into this pavilion at Expo 67, and they would do this unbelievable live demonstration. And Dr. George Speak, linked to Moody, the demonstrations they did were unbelievable. There was one demonstration they did where he stood on this metal platform, and they ran 1 million volts of electricity through his body. And he held a cricket bat. With aluminum foil, he held this cricket bat over his head. And the 1 million volts would go charging through his body and would come out at the end of the cricket bat, and the cricket bat would literally burst into flame when the volts went through. And it was just unbelievable to see this in person. And then from there, he would talk about God and the power of God and the scientific world and etc. And people who were interested, they went into a second room where there was a film that they watched that explained the gospel, and then counselors would come and speak to them. When Expo 67 started, at the beginning of summer of 67, if you counted all of the evangelicals and evangelical churches in Quebec, in the whole province, the number was about 7,000 to 8,000 evangelical Protestant Christians in Quebec at the beginning of 1967. Over 3 months of the World's Fair, there are 48,000 people who went through the pavilion and signed commitment cards to accept Christ and ask for follow-up counseling. Imagine this, there's 8,000 professing, believing Christians, and you know, there's 48,000 people who suddenly want to be, this, the numbers were huge, very, very significant. The man who was asked to run this was taken from a pharmaceutical company, good friend. His name was Keith Price. Keith Price was a medical sales rep, and he was a great preacher, and they asked him to lead this. It was just a summer project. He took a couple months off this job, and it worked really well. And out of this came an organization called Christian Direction that helps churches around the city, and they just celebrated their 50th anniversary. We really loved Keith Price. He's a great man, great preacher, and he preached in several of our assemblies regularly, and he spearheaded many other things, and they were involved when we worked to bring Billy Graham to Quebec and Leighton Ford to Quebec. Christian Direction and Keith were involved. And we met with Keith Price at one point, and Keith Price told us that he was stepping down, he was retiring. And Keith had just turned 60. And we said, Keith, what do you mean you're retiring? You know, you're just reached your, you know, your cruising speed. You know, everybody likes you. You're a great preacher. You've got the skill. What do you mean you're stepping down? And he says, well, he says, this week, he says, I got a letter from a young man who told me that it was time for me to step down. And we said, what do you mean? Like, who in the world would have the hubris and the gall and the nerve to write a letter to Keith Price, this beloved Christian leader, to, you know, and tell him that it was time to go? And he said, well, actually, he says, the letter was from me. He says, I was 35, and I was an elder in a local congregation. And there were a couple of really old men in the congregation who were hanging on to power, hanging on to power, hanging on to power, wouldn't share the leadership. And we got really frustrated, and we realized it was time for them to step down and let younger men come in and assume some leadership. And he said, that was so frustrating. He says that I wrote a letter to myself to be opened on your 60th birthday, where I told myself, you're 60 now. You've had your shot. There's younger leaders around you that you trust. It's time to step down and let them assume some of the control and the leadership. So he says, I turned 60 this week, and I pulled the letter out of my file that I'd written to myself 25 years ago. So he says, I'm listening, I'm retiring, I'm stepping down. We got to know when it's time to step down. We got to know when we're in over our head. And finally, the story ends with a few notes of grace, particularly in the way that Saul is mourned. It's almost funny to me that we're very, very concerned. I'm sure you are, if you admit to yourself. We're very concerned about the way other people will remember us when we're gone, about the grace that others will have when they think back to our mistakes. And I have to confess that I'm not sure I always give that to somebody else. When I look at a brother's life and at how he's doing, how easy it is for me to focus on the mistakes and the screw-ups, and how hard it is for me to dwell on the positive. And as Saul dies, there's two things that happen. Two things that happen in the way that he's mourned that are really touching. Did you notice who buries him? It's the men of Jabesh-Gilead. You know why them? Story's come full circle, hasn't it? You remember the first thing Saul did, the thing he did right? He heard the pleas for help from this little city, and he went and he saved their bacon, and they never forgot. And in spite of all the mistakes that he'd made, and in spite of all the screw-ups, and in spite of everything that Saul did wrong, they always remembered, this is the man that saved us. And at the risk of their life, they went into Philistine territory, recovered the body, brought them home, and buried them with full military honors. And then there is David's lament. Take a look at 2 Samuel chapter 1. Just want to read the verses with you. 2 Samuel chapter 1, and just starting at verse 17. And David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and Jonathan his son. And he said it should be taught to the people of Judah, Behold, it is written in the book of Jashar. I don't know why they don't translate the Hebrew there. The expression in Hebrew means the book of heroes. And they chose to keep the Hebrew word, but in fact, it's written in the book of heroes. So Israel had a commemorative book of heroes, and this is written in it. Your glory, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon. Gath and Ashkelon are the two leading cities of the Philistines. Lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice. Lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. You mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew or rain upon you, no fields of offerings. David is cursing the ground where Saul died. He said, this is hallowed ground. Let no crops grow there anymore. Let it stay barren in memory of Saul. For the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back. And the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely, in life and in death, they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. You daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, and who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of battle. Jonathan lies slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen, and the weapons of war have perished. Amen. Those three lessons today. Alternate endings. What do you need to do now so that the end plays out the way you'd like it to? The grace, the graciousness with which we remember one another, significant that is. Got a couple minutes if there's a couple of things that have been bothering you, questions that you've got. We're 10:30 for the Eucharist, right? We do have a few minutes for...
Yeah. Don't believe this clock. We changed every clock in the place except that one.
Okay. I panicked at one point. You probably caught that. I took a look at that clock and I thought, oh man. Either I'm speaking more slowly than I thought, or we're in a time warp.
The image that you provided comes from the Cathedral of Ely in England.
Okay. So it's the Cathedral of Ely in England. Ely.
Pardon my French.
Yeah.
One of your alternative endings, did you consider the skull that may not have been born? Jonathan would have been the wingman who said,
interesting, isn't it? Yeah, Jeff, I don't know if you heard, Jeff made an interesting suggestion. In one of the alternate universes, what if Jonathan survives and Jonathan becomes a close enough friend of David that David doesn't stay home and doesn't commit sin with Bathsheba and doesn't have Solomon and doesn't, you know. But that's the whole issue of change in the future and how you go. And you know, the funny thing is, though, that I'm... sometimes people say that God manages to make his will work out in spite of our mistakes. But it's even more gracious than that. There's almost a way in which God even manages to take our mistakes and turn them around and use them into the fulfilling of his will. And you remember, and the phrase, of course, is what Joseph says to his brothers at the end of Genesis when he's reunited with his brothers. And he says, you meant it for evil, but God used it for good, and God's ability to do that. And of course, that doesn't mean that we sin so that, you know, God can turn it to good.
You talked quite a bit about anger in relation to Saul and ourselves, and we're often taught in the Christian life that we're supposed to, that it's about, you know, sort of being mild and gentle and positive. And I take it that you're not saying that that's an entirely adequate account of the Christian life, because anger has this role in enabling us to do things. But what I wondered is, if you had anything to say about how you move from, if you've been in this sort of, we're supposed to be mild and gentle kind of framework, how you move from there to kind of liberating your anger, which has its uncontrollable and nasty side, and keeping it within the kingdom of God, under the rule of God,
There are two issues there, and one is what our character and natural personality is like. And I'm usually fairly mild and subdued, but there's times where I surprise myself. We'd been married about a year and a half. We'd bought our first house, and Debbie and I had our first big fight. And I don't remember what it was about. But I remember the frustration welling up in me like I have never seen it before. And it's that uncanny thing, you know, because it's the people who are closest to us who have the most possibility to do us good who also bring out the greatest frustration and, you know. In a fit of anger as things were going back and forth, Debbie just, you know, wisely walked away, closed the door, went for a walk, and I was just I swung and I put my fist right through a wall, right through both sides of the gyprock, like side to side, up to the elbow. And also I looked and I thought, oh my God, I'm like, And I think God used that because I needed to be scared. It was the first time I had been confronted with the possibility of damage that my anger could do. I didn't grow up in a violent home. There was no domestic, you know, it was like, and I'd always, you know, assumed that these kinds of things, and I saw this, and I saw the wall, and I got to tell you, I've done a lot of home renovations since. That was my first wallboard patching job, and it wasn't very good. And we had to move a painting. And on that wall, there was a painting that was off center. And everybody would come visit and go, isn't that painting off? Yes, it is. How come that painting? It's long, you don't want to know the story. It's just the painting. It's okay. I know the painting's off center. But it was this constant reminder. Peters, this is what you can do when your anger gets out of. The need is we control our anger to recognize where the hot buttons are, to realize what sets us off, to realize when it's time to go for a walk, to realize when it's time to shut down the file and walk away from the computer, to count to 10 before you answer that nasty email. There's those coping mechanisms that you need to work through and work yourself through in terms of the control with your personality issues. In terms of getting the what I call the drive and the passion, for me, it's come from being connected to things that you can do something about. And here, I think, is where the problem is. Because we watch the news too much, we see horrible, horrific things happening a world away that we can do nothing about. And I think what that does is that desensitizes us. And so we are so used to seeing starving people a world away that we can't do anything about that in our brain what goes off is, okay, people are hungry, so yeah, okay, I can't, okay. You get used to seeing hungry people. And then as I got to Côte de Neige and the Lord challenged us with what was around us, and Gordon, you've heard this so many times, the people at Côte de Neige have heard it so many times, they're almost tired of hearing it. But within 15-minute walk of the front doors of Côte de Neige, there are 8,600 and change children between the ages of 5 and 12 who are going to go to bed hungry tonight. And I keep saying that. Of the 10 poorest postal code zones in Canada, because that's how we do the demographics, so the 10 poorest postal code zones in Canada, 3 of them are within walking distance of the front door of the church where I pastor. And that's not okay with me, that there's 8,600 kids and change who are going to go to bed hungry tonight. I've got 420 households in Côte de Neige who are led by single moms who are below the sub-poverty line. That means they're making less than $11,000 a year. They have three kids or more, and they're living in an apartment with one bedroom or less. The single mom alone, usually about 25 or a little younger, with three kids, living on less than $11,000 a year, living in an apartment that has one bedroom or less. That means a studio. And one of the struggles is to get people tuned in to the things that are so close that they can do something about it, because we've been desensitized, and so we've lost our sense of anger. And so I've got 800 apartment units in Côte de Neige without running water, entirely illegal. But most of them are lived in by people who technically don't exist, so they're not legally here. They don't exist in the system. They're here working under the table. Somehow they got in, but they're hungry. They have needs, and their landlord's taking advantage of them. And I got to tell you, those things make me angry, and they make me angry enough that I go to city council meetings every month. I'm at city council meetings, and when there's a chance, I stand, I ask a question, I push the issue, I push the issue, I push the issue, and sometimes I raise my voice. Now, there's a funny thing that happens at city council. I've been there for 5 years. In the 5 years, I've been going every month to city council, asking questions, building relationships with the city council. The only other time I've ever seen another member of the clergy is when they're upset about zoning or about the parking lot they want that the city won't give them. And so every year and a half, some pastor, some minister, some priest shows up and he's angry about a parking lot. And you know, he pounds his fist, raises his voice, we want a parking lot, we want zoning, we want... And the city council goes, yeah, get in line, that's fine. And it's funny, there's still a running joke between them. They can't believe that there's not something I want. And after 5 years of being there, talking about poverty, about subsidized housing, about the things, the needs, about the schools where we need to be, breakfast programs, lunch programs, the things that really get me angry every so often. And it's usually Marvin Rotan from Snowden. He's got a great sense of humor. So we chat, and we'll working with the Mayor's Roundtable Against Poverty, we're doing this neat stuff together, and every so often Marvin will look at me and goes, no, why are you really here? You really want a parking lot, don't you? That's why you're really here. For 5 years, you've just been pulling our legs talking about poverty and food. What you really want is a parking lot. And unfortunately, people see us as Christians, as people that are upset about parking lots, and about zoning issues, and not upset about a lot of other stuff. And I'm not sure, David, how well I'm answering your question, but for me, most of our people are living comfortable, placid lives with nice jobs, in nice cars, going to nice jobs, nice homes, with nice families. They're really comfortable. And the only thing they have to get upset about is that somebody cut them off on the Dakari. Because they don't know about anything else that would raise their, and to people in this context, the fact that there's starving people three blocks away, the fact that there's stuff that's something to be angry about. That's something to be angry about.
I just wanted to share a quote from C.S. Lewis. Can't go back and change the beginning, but you can start from where you are and change the end.
Yeah. How many stories do you know of good kids who had everything going for them who ended bad, right? And how many stories do you know of people that everybody had written off that would never amount to anything, who wound up accomplishing great things? It's not even a surprise anymore, because it happens so often. My favorite story is this guy. He was born just before the revolution in Russia in 1917. And his parents got on the wrong side of the revolution. They ran a farm, and because they wouldn't support the revolution, the revolutionary forces came in, took their farm away, but they kept this young man and his parents as enslaved labor on the farm that used to belong to them. They banished them to the back of the farm, and he grew up from the time he was 3 until he was 17 in Siberia. He lived in a shack with no running water, with a dirt floor that was obviously frozen 8 months of the year. This is how he grew up until he was 14, 15. He didn't go to high school, so he decided to move to the city with a buddy to force himself through high school. He finally was able to write the high school termination and completion exams. He snuck into the university by the skin of his teeth. He got there, he got into the military program, and then in the military program, he got interested in flight. He wanted to fly because he understood the engineering of flight, but he couldn't fly because all of the flying positions were reserved for elite. You know, this was the revolution. There aren't supposed to be elite monarchy, but they were still the elite of the revolution. He couldn't get in there. He fought his whole life, and finally, at one point, because there was an opening, because somebody got sick, he got into the flight program, and he got into the fighter jet program. And then from there, he did so well that he went through the echelons, and eventually, Yuri Gagarin became the first man in space. Do you realize that Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space, grew up in a shack in Russia with a dirt floor 8 months a year? Do you realize that? Who knew? Thank you for your patience and for listening. You have a phone number for me and an email. Let's continue the conversation. I've been glad to get to know many of you. I will continue to pray for those of you that we chatted with. And if there's anything I can do to help, please don't hesitate. The email is a good way. If you email me, I will respond. Sometimes it might take me a day or two, but I will respond. Let's have a little word of prayer together. Father, we want to thank you for the life of Saul. We want to thank you for the things that we learn. Father, as we have heard your word, as your Spirit has worked in our hearts, we have made some decisions over the last 2 or 3 days. I pray that as we go home, you would give us the courage to honor those decisions and to work them through. And Father, some of us have been brought close to the edge of a decision, to a change that we need to make, but we're not quite there yet. Father, let us not lose this moment. In the days ahead, may these passions, these drives that you've woken in us, may they come to fruition, to fruit. Help us to yield to the work of your Spirit. We have been hearers of the word. Help us now to be doers of the word. In Christ's name, amen.